rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, this is the Redbox Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing you the best of my Times radio show. You can listen live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times radio app. Coming up on today's episode, it's Sunak versus Musk, one of the weirdest political events I've ever been to. In Lancaster House, the set of The Crown, no less, or at least where they film The Crown, a lot of it, because it looks like Buckingham Palace. Rishi Sunak, the actual Prime Minister, sat down and interviewed Elon Musk about the future of AI and how robots could become your best friend, but eventually the humanoids might chase you up the stairs or something. We unpack all of that, try to work out what we've actually learned. And is Elon Musk the sort of guy that Rishi Sunak should be essentially sucking up to? We'll hear from a couple of people who worked with him up until the point he fired him at Twitter. That's coming up in just a moment. James Marriott and India Knight coming up as well. But first, as we always do on a Friday, let's take a look at what we learned this week. We learned, did you know this, that we've got a new podcast? The security minister, Tom Tugendhat, knows all about it.
No, what the Prime Minister's doing is trying to put the Britain front and centre of the next industrial revolution. This is much more important than a podcast, I'm afraid. Don't tell Matt all that.
He'll be listening.
Yeah, I'm listening. On the podcast, How to Win an Election, we learned that Danny Finkelstein is exasperated with Rishi Sunak.
I cannot understand why Rishi Sunak has not said what he definitely thinks, which is, I picked up after two immediate disasters which had gone off the rails.
We learned that Polly McKenzie knows a lot about crazy golf.
Bournemouth does have the best crazy golf really of crazy all of the golf. Beach resorts in the United Kingdom.
And we learned that Peter Mandelson loves a metaphor.
The conference fell flat, the pillars were not put in place, the springboard is looking, you know, decidedly floppy.
Floppy. At the COVID inquiry, we learned that Boris Johnson asked if he should blow a special hairdryer up his nose to kill COVID. Which at least explains why his hair's such a mess. We learn that Dominic Cummings still thinks everyone else is an idiot.
I think I was reflecting a widespread view amongst competent people at the centre of power at the time about the calibre of a lot of senior people who are dealing with this crisis extremely badly.
And when he finds out who the who him promoted Boris Johnson, threw vote leave, supported him, re-elected him, covered up for him, and desperately clung on until he got the sack, he's going to grind them into swill and feed them to the
useless.
And we learned that Rishi Sunak's big idea to deal with the rise of the robots is
any of these movies, trains, subways, metros, cars, buses. They said all these movies with the same plot fundamentally all end with the person turning it off.
And that is what we learned this week. And you can subscribe to How to Win an Election right now, wherever you're listening to this. Right, now it's time for these two.
The Columnists with Knight at the Marriott. India Knight and James Marriott.
I was hunched on my bedroom floor of my laptop, frantically battering away at my column.
On Times Radio.
We'll talk about James and his column in a moment. Let's talk first about Elon Musk and Rishi Sunak. Their funny little meeting last night. And the idea that eventually we'll all be put out of work. This is what Elon Musk said.
There will come a point where
no job is needed. You can have a job if you want to have a job for sort of personal satisfaction, but the AI will be able to do everything.
So eventually there'll come a point when no job is needed. And I thought, you know, you can just have a job if you want to. I could never think of Rishi Sunak probably thought, yeah, you just marry a billionaire's daughter. What do you make of this idea that AI might mean that work will become optional?
I quite like it. I mean, I'm not against it in principle. I think it was really interesting when I thought what he said was that was interesting was the idea that in that case, the thing becomes about finding a, you know, finding meaning in life if there's no work to give you a sense of self and an identity. But I'm not opposed to the idea. I mean, people are going to have to develop some really good and kind of all-consuming hobbies, I guess. I don't know, what do you think? I mean, it's not unappealing.
I suppose fundamentally, most people currently don't have work for, you know, because it's nice. It's because you need to be able to pay for a roof over your head and buy some food. And
did he say where the money for the roof was coming
from?
No,
he said, because there was a discussion about, what do they call it, universal basic income, the idea that everyone would have a guaranteed amount of money. Unclear, because presumably coming from the government, but unclear how you raise the money for that if nobody's working. And then he said, no, not universal basic income. He said universal high income. And everyone went,
but you've got lots of money from the government and nothing to do, and you just mill about all day.
Yeah. I mean, and everyone sort of giggled without really knowing what that meant. And it wasn't clear where that money comes from, because if nobody's working to pay tax, then unless you tax the robots, do the robots pay tax? It's not clear, India.
I mean, it's not clear at all.
The only thing we could all really hope is we'll all be dead before this happens.
Yeah, I think it's some way away. So, yeah, we'll be long gone.
Right. Is James alive? That's the bigger question. James, are you there?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear, James. James, are you looking are you looking forward to being replaced by a robot?
No, I'm not, actually. I do. It's something I do worry about. It's one of those strange things where it sounds incredibly futuristic, but, you know, if, for instance, I don't know if either of you know people working in advertising copywriting, but those sorts of jobs are already being replaced by ChatGPT and, you know, people who work for advertising copywriting companies already finding that, you know, a team of sort of like five copywriters is now down to one who's just sort of overseeing robot writing. And I don't know, I mean, it sort of sounds appealing in the abstract, but I think when it actually arrives, it will be less, you know, none of those people who I've heard of have lost jobs to AI are particularly happy about it. And I don't think I'll be very happy about it if and when it happens to me. But I do also think that probably widespread job losses are more distant than that. It'll probably, I imagine, it'll be quite gradual, you know, initially.
Yeah, the thing that I found odd about this conversation last night, and actually about the conversation they've been having all week at this summit, is there's no real like effort, as far as I can tell, to put sort of timescales on it. So you're on the one hand of Rishi Sunak saying, literally sitting and telling the richest man in the world about gov.uk, where you can go online and renew your driving license or your passport, and saying they're going to start using AI in that to try and speed things up, which is sort of, you know, that seems like the sort of thing, you know, the same way that AI might serve up adverts on your website because it knows where you live. That, you know, that I could get. And then it's quite a big leap from that to be careful because there's a robot coming up your stairs and it wants to kill you. And I don't. There's clearly a long timeline in that. No one seems to really want to grapple with when we're talking about India.
No, and there's no sort of there's no chronology, you know. So you don't know when the robot that is also apparently going to be your best friend and your confidant and know you better than you know yourself. I mean, no thanks. But you don't know when that might happen. Is he talking about now? Do people have very intimate relationships with chatbots? I think they probably do, some of them who are stuck at home, and I don't know. I find it much more alarming than exciting. I find it exciting in the context of things like medicine, because clearly quite remarkable things are happening already and are likely to happen in the near future. But all of this more abstract stuff, like not having jobs and free money and your best friend robot coming to murder you, you know, it would be quite handy to know
Yeah, if you
could when pick, that was when likely that was happening.
Given that we can't get a train to arrive on time, it seems quite a long way off before a robot comes up your stairs. Mm. But anyway, James, the thing is, you don't need to worry about a robot coming for you and doing away with the need for your column, because you've already done it in your own column by writing this week.
Was this a mistake?
That people should stop having opinions, says columnist.
Yeah, I know. I'm sort of wondering about that one. I do wonder whether I've...
He's gone again. He's gone again. I'll tell you what, if we could replace James Marriott with a bot, it would be a damn sight easier.
Can you hear me?
At least the bot would probably come into the room, come into the studio. India, what did you think of James's suggestion? I mean, the headline point was I thought, probably quite good. That you don't need to have an opinion on everything. And he sort of drew a line from the amateur epidemiologists during the COVID lockdown. Mm. They all then became experts in military hardware during Ukraine. And now they're all experts on Middle Eastern history and how you solve the Israel-Gaza conflict. We just don't need to have a hot take on everything, do we?
No, we don't need to have a hot take on everything. The problem is, we sort of feel like we do, whether we're journalists or not, because anyone who uses social media can't, we know, we'll just get kind of completely ignored and steamrolled if they just sit there and say what most people think, which is, and I'm somewhere in the middle, I'm not sure, that's interesting, but that's also interesting, not really sure, haven't made up my mind yet, you know. But you can't, you have to stick out and you have to trumpet an opinion very loudly. And as James says in his column, you know, that often means acquiring an opinion very, very quickly, thanks to Wikipedia. And then the whole exercise becomes completely meaningless and pointless.
Right, let's try one more time. James, are you there?
I'm here. Well, I'm here. I feel like I'm here.
Well, we can hear you. We can hear you. James, explain why you think you should give up your column in The Times.
Well, that wasn't quite what I was going for. And it is a difficult balance because, obviously, you know, as I said in the piece, you know, I think it's not unreasonable to be outraged and upset by what's happening in Gaza. I guess the argument really was against ill-informed opinion, knee-jerk opinion, which I don't really think helps anyone. I mean, anyone who's been on Twitter and Instagram will just see that, you know, a million people seem to have turned themselves into amateur experts on Israel and Gaza and have all kinds of horribly badly informed opinions. And my feeling is that sort of tends to lead to, you know, fake news, unhelpful levels of outrage that are directed in unhelpful places. And also, I think a lot of really angry opinions end up just sort of backfiring on you. And if you have an angry, ignorant opinion, you're not really helping your own side. You're just kind of proving to your enemies how dumb your point of view is. And I don't know, it's made me despair a little bit. I mean, as you say, it's kind of hard for an opinion columnist to say this, as, you know, I'm paid to have opinions. But sometimes, you know, it's good to sacrifice, you know, one's a bit of professional hypocrisy in order to try and say something that you think is true, even if it also rebounds on you.
So I think the timing of this was you wrote your column and it went online, and then perhaps the best example of people getting performatively cross about everything came along. I think this is one of my favourite stories in ages, is the Marks and Spencer story. So the Marks and Spencer Christmas adverts released, and I think the gist of it is they're sort of doing away with all the naff things about Christmas, and it included a clip they put online of three Christmas cracker hats being thrown into the fire. They happen to be silver, red and green. And the internet decided, or performative idiots decided, that this looked like the Palestinian flag. It's now been deleted by Marks and Spencer, who've apologised for any hurt caused by the burning of some Christmas cracker hats in August, and making clear that it was not a comment on the current crisis in the Middle East. Are we now beyond saving, India?
Yes, I think we became beyond saving a little while ago, actually. But although I do think about that story, admit, you know, of course those are Christmassy colours, and of course they didn't mean anything by when they shot the thing in August. But they posted it yesterday or the day before, and it is no longer August, and we're all aware of what's going on in the Middle East. So somebody somewhere in their, you know, massively well-remunerated advertising agency should have gone, hang on a minute. I think, you know, generally when you're burning stuff, a good rule is to say, do the colours of what we're burning look a bit like a flag, any flag from anywhere, you know, have Google open on world flags and sort of keep an eye. But no, we are far beyond saving. The ship has sailed, I'm afraid.
It's a good point, actually, you're making it. Because, James, we've all done it when we're doing promotional things. You know, you don't want a snatched photo. You wouldn't put out the one that looks a bit like you're doing a Hitler salute, even if you weren't doing a Hitler salute. You know, you look at, you know, the trying to look, I suppose that's part of the job of the creative process, is looking for the exactly these bear traps.
Yeah, exactly. Although, I mean, as you know, as someone who writes a column and, you know, discovers that people are outraged with you for all kinds of confusing reasons you would not have begun to anticipate, I do think it is hard to work out what people are going to get cross about. And one of the great lessons of column writing for me is it's never, ever the thing you really think, or very rarely is the thing you think. It's be something completely you assumed innocent and totally beside the main point that outrages people. And I think I'm a bit more pessimistic than India about the power of these well-paid advertising executives to always predict what the outrage is. I mean, to be honest, I imagine there are hundreds of stupid mistakes that are caught that we don't see, but it's inevitable that something like this will slip through, because I can't imagine having predicted that people would have this response to that advert.
Yeah, well, we when we were doing the promotion for How to Win an Election, we got Peter Mandelson to dress up as Hitler, and then it was only afterwards we realised maybe we won't put those pictures out. To be absolutely clear, that is not true. That is not true. James, have you heard any good podcasts lately?
Heard any good podcasts? Well, there was one, you know. What was it called? I think, was Matt Chorley involved in it?
Yeah, you wrote a nice little review, didn't you, James?
Yeah, I reviewed you, so you've got to be really nice to me now, because I said that you were very good at making podcasts, specifically How to Win an Election with Daniel Finkelstein, Peter Mandelson and Polly McKenzie. Am I doing the advertorial stuff right?
Yeah, doing very well, James. Yeah. You can get that job now. You could be the one person left doing all the advertorial copy. India Knight and James Marriott there, and of course you can read them both in The Times and The Sunday Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, it's Musk versus Sunak.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
You're listening to the Redbox Podcast. Now, it's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
I've seen some weird stuff in politics in my time. David Cameron, with his hands down his trousers, the first time I met him in his front room. He was just tucking his shirt in. It was a different time. Theresa May moving sort of in time to Dancing Queen. Jeremy Corbyn high-fiving Emily Thornby's breast. Charles Walker walking around Parliament with a pint of milk. Alex Salmond feeding a student a Solero. Ed Miliband's two kitchens. All very weird. But nothing quite as weird as last night's loving.
All right, well, good evening, everybody. Welcome. Elon, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We feel very privileged. We're excited to have you. Right, so I'm going to start with some questions and then we're going to open it up. Let me get straight into it.
You've got a friend in me. You've got a friend in me. When the road looks rough ahead and your mind miles from your nice warm bed, you just remember but what you pass it. For you got a friend in me.
Yeah, it was very, very, very weird. I went to Lancaster House last night to see Rishi Sunak interviewing Elon Musk, the guy behind Tesla, the guy behind the rockets, the guy now behind X, formerly Twitter. And I couldn't help thinking, why is the actual Prime Minister of Great Britain and Northern Ireland sitting there like Gloria Hunniford, hanging on every word of this guy who basically bought Twitter and drove it towards the ground faster than one of his early rockets? Is that a wise thing to do? And what did we learn about the two men and also the prospect of us all being murdered in our beds by robots? In a moment, we're going to hear from some people who know Elon Musk because he fired them when he took over Twitter. But first, I'm joined by Jessica Frank-Keys. She was there last night for City AM. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Matt. How's it going?
I'm very well. I'm very well. Just sum up the morning after the night before. How weird was it?
I think it's been sinking in, hasn't it? I saw Sam Coates from Sky News saying quite quickly after the event that it was one of the strangest things he's ever covered as a journalist. Obviously, he's got far more experience than me, but I would also agree that the tone was just incredibly strange. I think it was the contrast of this. You were there, obviously, as you said, this gold-plated, high-ceilinged, ornate room, you know, with the sort of, you know, black backdrop of Rishi Sunak ex Elon Musk talking about, Terminator films, humanoid robots. You were just sort of going, I can't really believe what I'm hearing and where I'm hearing it. It was very odd.
There was something very odd, I mean, peculiar about the Prime Minister doing the interviewing. And let's be honest, they were pretty softball questions as well. So let's go through some of what they discussed and we'll try to work out what we're learning about Rishi Sunak and Elon Musk and what it means for us. So Rishi Sunak early on asked Elon Musk about the impact of AI on jobs.
There will come a point where no job is needed. You can have a job if you want to have a job for sort of personal satisfaction, but the AI will be able to do everything. So I don't know if that makes people comfortable or uncomfortable.
There was a lot of that slightly awkward, maniacal laughing going on, Jessica.
Yes. Quite a nervous laugh there from the Prime Minister, who obviously, as a Conservative, as he said himself during that interview that he was conducting, you know, as a Conservative, I believe in the value of work, the importance of work to us as a society and to people's lives. And Elon referenced that as well in saying that one of the challenges of the future is going to be how do we extract meaning from our lives if essentially robots can do everything? What does that mean? And, you know, we should say that we've had these kind of existential questions thrown up by new technology before, like even going back to the Industrial Revolution, the creation of the internet. But it's certainly a theme that's coming up again now, because I think that it is something that risks being incredibly destabilizing, potentially. We obviously don't know at the moment where these technologies are going to go.
And what struck me, what surprised me, well, two things actually surprised me about Elon Musk. One, how softly spoken he was. Given his character online, his sort of online presence is quite a sort of bombastic, aggressive, shouty, you know, Twitterer. He was, you know, at times I could barely hear what he was saying. He was sort of quite softly spoken. Maybe that speaks to, you know, keyboard warriors who are more shouty online than they are in person. But also it was just that both Rishi Sunak and Elon Musk seem to be sort of, they seem to know as much about this as you and I do. It was sort of like, oh yeah, no, that could happen, couldn't it? Well, don't be bad, wouldn't it? Without any real sense of sort of time scale or practicalities. And at one point they talked about a universal basic income or a universal high income without thinking, well, where does that money come from? You know, if you're going to be paying people money to sit at home and do nothing, do you tax the robots? None of that was really clear. There were some upsides to this, though, apparently. This is Elon Musk talking about some of the upsides of robots taking over our lives.
Look at the landscape of things that you see as possible. What is it that, you know, you are particularly excited about?
I think certainly AI tutors are going to be amazing. Perhaps already are. I think there's also perhaps companionship, which may seem odd because how can the computer really be your friend? But if you have an AI that has memory, you know, and remembers all of your interactions, and has read everything. You're going to say, like, give it permission to read everything you've ever done. So it really will know you better than anyone, perhaps even yourself. And where you can talk to it every day, and those conversations build upon each other, you will actually have a great friend. As long as that friend can stay your friend and not get turned off or something. Don't turn off my friend. But I think that will actually be a real thing.
The more
that nervous laughter again.
Nervous laughter again. It's very peculiar. And it seems to me just a slight misunderstanding of just what the point of a friend is. And it's not just to repeat back everything you've ever said. I mean, actually, the idea of a friend remembering everything you've ever said is slightly terrifying.
I'd have to agree. I would suggest that maybe me as a person, I haven't always been at the forefront of embracing technological change. I think I remember trying to persuade my housemate at the time not to install smart bulbs in all our rooms because, you know, what if all the robots broke and we could never turn the lights off? It would be horrible. But I think it was two things from that, really, that sort of chunk there from Elon, both on the friend and the teaching side. My mum's a teacher and fantastic. Obviously, if AI can cut down the marking and the lesson planning that teachers have to do, which, you know, takes up so much time. But there's so much more to being a teacher, I think, than just kind of, you know, teaching people how to pass exams or how to understand, you know, math equations. Like, there's the whole, like you say about a friend, there's the whole pastoral passing on sort of moral values, providing emotional support, you know, just really being a kind of a figure of guidance in like kids' lives. And I just think we have to think very carefully about how are we going to engage with that.
Yeah, you sort of got the feeling that maybe he hadn't had an actual friend before and he just thought that all a friend did was reminded you of all the other things that you've said. It was very peculiar. Anyway, let's that was one of the upsides, remember, the tutors and friends and all that. Yeah. Let's look now at some of the downsides. Now, it seems that all this week, no one can talk about AI without mentioning sort of slightly vaguely James Cameron films, when of course they mean Terminator.
But if you have a humanoid robot, it can basically chase you anywhere. So I think we should have some kind of hardwired local cutoff. That you can't update from the internet. So anything that can be software updated from the internet obviously can be overridden. But if you have a local sort of off switch where you perhaps say a keyword or something and then that puts the robot into a safe state, some kind of localized safe state ability, an off switch, you know, where you don't have to get too close to the robot. I don't know. So if we've got millions of these things going all over the place.
You're not selling it. Just, you know, like that.
No, I know. I'm saying this is something we should be quite concerned about. Because if the robot can follow you anywhere, then what if they just one day get a software update and they're not so friendly anymore?
Great. Well, luckily, Rishi Sunak had a solution.
It's funny you're saying that because in our session that we had today, I would say who, but they made exactly the same point, right, Dennis? So they're talking about movies, actually without mentioning James Cameron, they're talking about James Cameron movies. And they're saying, if you think about it, it's not just those movies, but any of these movies, trains, subways, metros, cars, buses, they said all these movies with the same plot fundamentally all end with the person turning it off, right, or finding a way to shut the thing down. And they were making the same point that you were about the importance of actual physical off switches.
Jessica, I just couldn't help thinking we were supposed to be seeing the two people, two tech-savvy, world-leading voices on this subject, and the best that either of them could come up with was to turn it off and turn it back on again.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting because as an interviewer, you know, if you sit down with somebody to ask some questions, you often find yourself sort of guided by the kind of road they want to go down with the conversation because, you know, obviously you're trying to find out their stance on an issue. And that was the role that Rishi Sunak cast himself in last night as the interviewer. And I think perhaps we saw more of what Elon Musk thinks about AI than we learned about what Rishi Sunak really thinks. I think, you know, maybe the last 2 days of the Bletchley Park summit, we would have got a bit more insight into kind of at a government level, you know, where these conversations are going. But it was, as you said earlier, it was all at a very vague, theoretical, haha, wouldn't that be bad level, which, you know, that's fine from Musk as a businessman, but I think as a from a from the Prime Minister, you know, we were kind of maybe not getting that window into the more detailed conversations, which you'd hope and I'm sure are going on.
And I sort of wondered who's the audience for this? Because if you are a very, you know, it was streamed later on Rishi Sunak and Elon Musk's X accounts. If you are a super engaged, you know, AI nerd about it, you know, you're right at the forefront of all this. You read all the blogs, you're looking at all the tech, you're completely absorbed by it. You must have thought this is like just drivel. This is just top level waffling about James Cameron films. If you are a curious, concerned person who's not really into this and you tuned in hoping to find out something or to seek reassurance, I'm not sure you'd have come away with it. Somebody who I know well, who was involved in sort of organising similar things, he wasn't involved in this AI summit, but a similar sort of government events and conferences and that sort of stuff, messaged me this morning. I find the odd and unspoken thing about the AI summit is the whole point was the public are quite fearful about AI, and that's because they don't think it's safe. So they decided to hold a big safety summit in order to reassure everyone. But actually, I think it's had the opposite effect of reminding everyone that it might not be that safe, like a pink elephant summit to ensure that no one thinks about pink elephants. And maybe that's what I sort of came away from it. There wasn't any reassurance or any sense of a sort of grip or a plan. Do you think that's fair?
I think we're in the very early stages. We obviously have had things like the Bletchley, get my words out, Park Declaration and the agreement that was announced yesterday, you know, coming out. But like you say, then go into that conversation with Elon Musk where, you know, he sounded worried at times.
Yeah.
And it's hard to know. It's hard to know kind of where this is going to go. But the fact that he was expressing, you know, some quite serious concerns about things like we really need to get China involved and actually being quite supportive of the idea of government regulation, which I think will have surprised some people.
That's true, yeah.
I think, yeah, we're at the early stages, but I don't know how reassuring. I don't know how reassuring I found it. I found it interesting.
Yeah, it was interesting. It was surprising, but yeah, probably not very reassuring. Let's focus on a couple of things we did learn then. We got a sense that we might have a general election from Rishi Sunak when he warned that the 2024 will be the first big run of global elections hit by AI. Let's take a listen.
I've already had a situation happen to me with a doctored image that goes everywhere, negative. By the time everyone realises, well, that's fake and we should stop sending it, the damage is done. And actually, we were, again, reflecting today. If you think next year you've got elections in, you know, I think, you know, the US, India, I think Indonesia, probably here. There you go. massive news.
So I think the doctored image he was talking about was one where he was putting pints at a beer festival, and there was someone stood behind him, it was a woman stood behind him, and somebody doctored her eyes to make it look like she was basically looking at him like, oh, this guy's an idiot, which was shared by lots of people, including a Labour MP. I'm not sure it's necessarily going to swing the election, but it's an example of how that stuff can go around. But, you know, some confirmation we'll have a general election next year, so at least we learned something, Jessica.
Yeah, and I think he did say probably next year, leaving himself yes, open exactly. to, you know, could we go as far as January 2025, which I'm sure some people will think, oh God, you know, and some people will think that's great, you know, that this will have time to turn things around. So we all know it's coming. And it is clear that I think AI and election interference has been one of the kind of big themes of, you know, the safety summit. And that's something that the world leaders across the world are going to be concerned about. Politically, though, I mean, I did wonder, you know, who, you know, talking about people who are concerned about AI, how reassured are they going to be? But in terms of Conservative voters and people who Sunak wants to try and win over, I was wondering who it is aimed at, because the sort of core Conservative vote maybe tends to be older. Are they people who are on Twitter, who are watching a live stream with Elon Musk? I'm not sure that my grandparents would have been tuning in.
And actually, the other sort of political fallout of this, and you know, in terms of Rishi Sunak's ability to connect with voters, the bit that's been seized on by certainly the Labour Party was when Rishi Sunak was talking to Elon Musk about how Britain could adopt a bit more of the Silicon Valley culture.
Right, it's how do you transpose that culture from places like Silicon Valley across the world, where people are unafraid to give up the security of a regular paycheck to go and start something, and be comfortable with failure. You talked about that a lot. I think you talked about it more in when you were playing games, right? But like, you've got to be comfortable failing and knowing that that's just part of the process. And that is it's a tricky cultural thing to do overnight, but it's an important part of, I think, creating that kind of environment.
Yeah, if you don't succeed with your first startup, it shouldn't be a sort of a catastrophic career-ending thing. It should be like, well, you know, you gave it a good shot, you know, and now try again.
And exactly.
Yeah.
And the Labour Party are out already this morning, Jessica, saying this just speaks to the problem of a very rich guy who knows, you know, with he's got money in the bank, and so you can start businesses and let them fail and all of that. And that's just a million miles away from lots of people's current experience.
Absolutely. And, you know, we talk a lot at CityM as well about encouraging and being in a position to support businesses to take risks, because that's obviously key to encouraging the economy to grow, which is in both Rishi Sunak's five pledges and Keir Starmer's missions is to get Britain growing. So there's that argument. But when I think it falls down is when you do try and apply it to ordinary people. I mean, just look at the furlough scheme and the amount of time it took for self-employed people to kind of come under the government protections when COVID hit. So I think
that's a really good point. The way that attitude actually feeds its way into policy. Yeah, Labour's front bench, John Ashworth, said, "How out of touch is Rishi Sunak? After 13 years of the Tories, the public are enjoying the worst cost of living crisis in memory. And he's spending his time telling Elon Musk that he wishes people would give up their jobs and be ready to fail. He hasn't got a clue." Which, having seen some of the reaction today, certainly resonated with some people. Jessica, thank you so much for taking us through it. I'm glad that you survived it as well, and you managed to, I hope, got some sleep overnight without the prospect of your dishwasher coming and doing you in. Jessica Frank-Keyes from City AM, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Good to speak to you. Now, one of the big questions is whether or not this was even a wise thing for Rishi Sunak to do, to sit down with Elon Musk. So I asked the Culture Secretary, Lucy Fraser, who sits in Rishi Sunak's cabinet, whether she thought it was a smart thing to do.
I think what we've got in the Global AI Summit is bringing together key people in this space to discuss the challenges that we face as a world. So, you know, bringing together a large number of countries together with key players in this space. We can't, as a country, solve these massive issues alone. And I think it's important to be able to talk to and understand the ideas of those who are intricately involved in thinking about these issues.
But there's talking to, and there's changing the number 10 logo on the doors of Downing Street to the X logo. That looks more like endorsement, you know, sidling up to, cozying up to Elon Musk. That's not just asking him what he thinks about AI regulation along with everyone else at the summit. You're not worried at all that this might be a step too far?
I'm not worried that there are going to be significant consequences for what's on the door of number 10 Downing Street for a couple of minutes. What I am keen on ensuring is that we, the UK, play a really significant role and are a world leader in what is one of the most fundamental challenges and opportunities that's coming down our path. And I think what our AI summit is going to do is really bring countries together, be a really focal point for making decisions, understanding these issues. And I'm really pleased that the UK is absolutely at the centre of that.
Culture Secretary Lucy Fraser there. Let's now speak to Simon Balmain, who was a community manager at Twitter. Hi, Simon.
Hi, Matt. How are you doing?
I'm very good. Why are you no longer a community manager at Twitter?
I was laid off along with about 85% of the company when Elon bought the company. So, yeah, that was about a year ago. Yep.
So how do you feel then seeing Rishi Sunak? I mean, the word I used in the Times today was simpering as he interviewed Elon Musk.
I think that's sounds like a very accurate characterization to me. The whole thing seemed very, very performative, very much a PR stunt by Rishi to make him seem like he knows what's going on, like he's on the ball with this stuff. And when actually, I think he probably isn't. From what I've heard that he says, it seems like he has a very rudimentary understanding of AI, in my opinion, and just wants to look good by cozying up to a fellow billionaire. I think I read your article. I thought it was great. I think the point that you ended on about tech only gets interesting when the creatives show up was absolutely on point. I come from a creative background myself, and that's absolutely correct. This whole meeting, I don't really see the value in it from what everything I've heard about it.
And give us a sense of that. I mean, the reason you and lots of other people aren't at Twitter/X anymore is because Elon Musk said there were too many people and you don't need all that. We can get rid of it all and the whole thing can be a success. And actually what we've seen since is it's become harder to use. The number of bots, misinformation, filth circulating on the site seems to have gone up, you know, anecdotally, if not people have done studies. But as a result, I mean, it's still incredibly influential. So should we be, I mean, what are the questions that Rishi Sunak should have been putting to Elon Musk if he was going to do that, about his ability to control what's been posted online and the impact that has on society, on politics around the world?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, if you know, this person is supposed to be the leader and the representative of our country, well, where is the questions about actually how you treated the UK staff in particular last year? You know, hundreds and hundreds of UK staff were you know, summarily laid off with very little process. There were lawsuits against that here, just like there were in the US. He didn't pay his rent on the HQ in London for many, many months, a building that was owned by the Crown Estate. You know, where's the questions about that? He shows up when it's good for him. In terms of the platform itself, you know, one of the changes that was made was that it's very difficult to go on the platform and not see everything that Elon tweets himself. He boosted himself up right to the top of everybody's timeline. Is that a good way to run a company, or is it the actions of a dictator?
And his role, it's not just, I suppose, what he can do through Twitter. The fact that he controls Starlink, the satellite internet system. You know, we've seen there've been conversations about his ability to basically turn that on and off in war zones, whether that's in Ukraine or potentially now in the Middle East. You know, this is a guy with incredible power to change the, not just, you know, what we might think about something by based on tweets that get surfaced, but literally a player in global politics, global conflicts.
Yeah, and I think that's one thing in itself to have that power. But when you see that that power is consolidated to a man that is very mercurial, makes decisions, you know, based upon whatever he feels like at any given time, that's actually quite dangerous. I think that's the real worry. And so for a leader to be cozying up in that way with somebody that's shown himself to be quite erratic and irrational at times, it's really strange. I don't know if somebody that I want to lead the company would support that and condone that and want to be so visibly, as you said, like pandering to that.
Yeah. I used the word strange there again. I think it's probably we've used the word strange and weird more during this item than anything we have for a very long time. Simon, it's really good to speak to you. Simon Bellman there, former community manager at Twitter, until he, along with hundreds of others, were fired by Elon Musk. And that's all we've got time for on that particularly peculiar event in politics. I definitely didn't dream it. It really did happen. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. And if you haven't done already, you've got the weekend to listen to the first episode of How to Win an Election, because there'll be another one along on Tuesday. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.